The sudden separation of a parent and child is one of life's most traumatic experiences. The immediate stress of it can be so intense, some researchers believe it can induce physical pain. In the long term, people speak of an aching heart, and in many ways, that's real. The Trump administration is harnessing the power of that pain to discourage illegal immigration. It's implemented a policy to deter immigrants from crossing the border by taking away their children when they're detained. Illegal border crossings have surged to 1,000 cases a week. In April, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services tracked 700 children who were separated from their parents. 400 of them were not even 4 years old. Now, making matters worse, children are being lost in the shuffle. Their parents are not only worried about being jailed, but also afraid they'll never see their children again. Honduran immigrant Marco Antonio Muñez is a case in point. He crossed the Rio Grande with his wife and three-year-old. The Customs and Border Protection Agency separated the family. Mom went to one facility, dad to another. The three-year-old was taken to yet another facility. While he was in jail for crossing the border illegally, Mr. Muñez died. Dad died by suicide. Jonathan Blitzer has been tracking cases like this. His article, How the Trump Administration Got Comfortable Separating Immigrant Kids from Their Parents, was published in The New Yorker. He's here today to walk us through the genesis of this policy and to help us understand what it means for these families and for America. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So immigration was always a major point on the Trump administration's agenda. What is this new border policy issued by Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration?
The policy itself is called zero tolerance. And the idea of the policy is anytime someone crosses the border illegally, that is to say, between an official port of entry, that person can be prosecuted criminally for entering the country illegally. And so the immediate consequence of that approach, the idea of criminalizing any border crosser, is that families are being separated because the parent who's crossing is being processed criminally. And while that's going on, that person's kid, if the person crosses with a child, is being taken into custody by the Department of Health and Human Services and held separately. And so the immediate effect of the policy is for these families to be separated once they cross the border.
Where did this idea of separating parents from children first surface? It seems so, you know, not to be offensive, but diabolically innovative.
You know, the administration has talked about doing this since the early spring of last year. John Kelly, who at the time was the head of the Department of Homeland Security, floated the idea publicly, was immediately met with outcry, and so seemed to back away from it. But clearly, the conversation around a policy like this continued at the Department of Homeland Security and elsewhere within the government, because the idea kept kind of resurfacing in policy discussions. And by the summer of 2017, there did seem to be cases where this was happening. And so you had lawyers and advocates at different places along the border reporting that parents would show up in custody without their kids. They'd be panicked. They'd be terrified. They could not figure out where their kids were. They didn't even know how to begin the process of identifying where their children were. And so this started last summer, and it kind of progressively, as evidence of this policy had surfaced, the government kind of offered different explanations for what it was doing. So at one point, the Trump administration said, look, we're only doing this because we're concerned about the kids. We want to make sure that the people, that the adults they're crossing the border with aren't smugglers or don't have any sort of nefarious purpose. So obviously, that's a pretty ridiculous pretense, but that was the pretense that was offered initially. And then over time, it kind of evolved, the government's rationale for doing this. Later this spring, April, May, the government actually came out and announced, okay, zero tolerance is real. And the way they justified zero tolerance wasn't to say, look, we need to separate families. They said simply, we need to prosecute illegal border crossers. That was all they said. And anytime you ask them, okay, but the net effect of that policy is immediately to separate families, they would say, well, that's not on us. If these people are crossing the border illegally, what do you want us to do?
You mentioned that they offered various explanations, and I'm getting from what you're saying is that obviously you didn't believe all the explanations, and that this technique of separating parents from children, the pain that it caused, that is the sting that they want to use to discourage people from crossing the border. I want to make sure that I'm clear. Is that accurate?
It is in part. I mean, I definitely think the idea is to cause maximum pain and difficulty for people who are attempting to cross the border into the U.S. I don't know specifically, and I don't mean to seem to hem and haw on this, I don't know specifically that the administration thought, okay, here's how we're going to scare people. We're going to torture their kids. I actually think in some ways it was just sort of callous. It was, the idea was, look, we just want to criminally prosecute anyone who enters. Who cares what the consequences are? That was kind of the thinking. Now, one reason why the administration has been a little bit wishy-washy about its rationale is that actually, once they get brought to court, it gets complicated for them to say that they're doing this simply to deter other people from crossing the border. Federal courts in the past have said, constitutionally, that's not valid. Mm. You can't treat people kind of in these kind of generally horrific ways simply to kind of drive broad immigration policy. And so there was a kind of weird inflection point in how the administration started to talk about this, because at first they said, look, we got to deter other border crossers. And then they kind of like weirdly started to shift away from that and say simply that, look, all we can do is prosecute people who cross the border illegally. They tried to shy away a little bit from the idea that they were doing this to deter people. But I think very clearly that was the intention, and government documents reveal that that was the intention. Conversations that occurred in various departments as this policy was being hatched make clear that this was the intention. So the idea very much is to, you know, make crossing such a perilous and difficult endeavor that people would reconsider. That's the theory. And in fact, the evidence actually tends to undercut that. I mean, as we've seen, the numbers of people crossing the border have not gone down as a result of this policy. Granted, it's a little bit early to tell. But on the whole, even when the government has attempted to do this sort of thing at more isolated stretches and patches along the border, the numbers have suggested that it hasn't appreciably changed the way in which people attempt to cross the border and seek asylum in the U.S. because we're dealing with factors that are huge. We're dealing with questions of violence in these people's home countries. We're dealing with a whole slew of factors that can't simply be combated by punishing people once they cross the border.
And yet some people perceive this as a punishment. You write about Gene Hamilton and how he had a light footprint. What role did he play in creating anti-immigration policy?
So there's a group of guys in the government who are all acolytes of Jeff Sessions. So they worked for Jeff Sessions when he was a senator, and once the Trump administration took office, they worked in different departments of the federal bureaucracy. So, you know, the most famous of these guys is Stephen Miller, who's at the White House, and a lesser known figure is this guy Gene Hamilton, who started at the Department of Homeland Security in a kind of senior advisory role. And he was behind a number of policies that were kind of stringently anti-immigrant, intensely anti-immigrant. So, for example, he was involved in helping to draft the Muslim ban. He was involved in helping to end DACA. He was a kind of major figure when John Kelly was the head of the Department of Homeland Security in calling for more aggressive enforcement measures. And so it was no surprise when I learned that he also had a hand in crafting and effectuating this zero tolerance policy and this family separation policy, because that's very much in keeping with kind of what his outlook and what his MO have been.
Hmm. If you're just joining us right now, I'm speaking with Jonathan Blitzer. He writes about how the U.S. government is separating immigrant children from their family, and his recent piece was published in The New Yorker. Jonathan, it seems like initially there was so much negative reaction to this, and then it finally moved forward. Was there a particular moment where suddenly they realized that this is a good policy? I'm trying to put this into perspective, because it would seem like the negative reaction when it was first proposed is still in existence, and yet the policy is real.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think maybe the way to think about that, I mean, I can't say for certain kind of what possesses the administration to kind of proceed ahead with a policy like this, either on moral grounds or, for that matter, political ones. It seems kind of unfathomable. But I think the way to think about it is to think instead that this was something that so many people within the administration were pushing for, that in the past, the only thing that kept it from becoming policy were a few kind of thin checks. And, you know, early on, when John Kelly first floated this idea in March of 2017, you know, it's relatively early in the administration. There had been this, at the Department of Homeland Security, there was this total disaster in the rollout of the Muslim ban, the travel ban. And so I think there was probably this perception relatively early on that, you know what, let's just not bring more controversy on ourselves with a policy like this. But I think that was, I think the reservations about instituting a policy like this were not necessarily driven by deep moral qualms or legal qualms, but instead had more to do with kind of timing and pacing in carrying out this broader agenda.
Timing, so, pacing, and how it looked, because there's controversy. It didn't look good back then.
That's right. And they certainly got more. They've certainly got more comfortable pursuing these anti-immigration measures in office. I also think that, you know, the MO of this White House has tended to be to double down on controversial measures, specifically when they involve immigrants. And so this kind of punitive policy at the border, I mean, it sounds horrible to say. It plays well with the president's base, because the idea is it allows the White House to claim that there is a crisis at the border and the White House is attempting to kind of carry out all of its campaign promises, all of the president's campaign promises, to correct this and to improve this crisis at the border. The crisis, of course, is totally artificial. It's of the administration's own making. I mean, what happens when you have people who are crossing the border and you're immediately arresting all of them and putting them in detention is there are problems of, okay, well, where do you house all of these people? How do the courts process all of these people? What do you do when their children are separated from them? These are problems that the administration created by instituting this policy. These weren't problems that existed before. But in the kind of political spin of it, it allows the administration to look like there is a legitimate border crisis that the president is taking strong action on.
You speak about this as a political tool. And that begs a question. Is this a sort of preemptive ethnic cleansing, an attempt to keep a white all-American narrative in effect?
I think there are all kinds of indications that the view of this administration has a strong racial dimension to it. Efforts to restrict legal immigration is further evidence of it. The idea that if you can change the complexion of who is allowed to come to this country legally, how you treat people who come to this country illegally. And to be clear, I don't want to make it sound like the people who are being swept up by this policy are all simply coming here illegally. Many of them are legitimately claiming asylum, and before we have a chance to see how their asylum claims play out, they're being criminalized. So I do think that there is a broader agenda here, and that a lot of the things that drive the intense enforcement measures are also things that align with deeper philosophical thinking about kind of redrawing what our legal immigration system looks like, and by extension, changing who we tend to admit and accept as immigrants in this country.
And when you say this, you kept on using the word people, but these are non-white people by and large. Is that the case? I just want to make sure that we're clear on that.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing is, when you hear people like Stephen Miller talk about this stuff, a lot of them look back, they kind of like point to specific watershed moments in American immigration history. And so Jeff Sessions, for example, has spoken publicly and fulsomely about laws from the 1920s that created a quota system for immigrants from different countries and from, at the time, quote-unquote, undesirable countries, Eastern Europe, elsewhere. In 1965, there was a major kind of rethinking and overhaul of the U.S. immigration system. And by and large, what happened after 1965 was that the types of people who were admitted into the U.S. were typically from places like Central and South America, Asia, East Asia, and those people obviously were people of color, different kind of wave of immigrants than in the past. And I think a lot of people in this administration, particularly the people kind of high up who are shaping kind of broad policy about legal immigration, when you listen to them talk, listen for these signposts. A lot, you know, Stephen Miller is frequently mentioning 1965. There is a reason for that.
What's the reason? Why 1965?
I think that's when these guys saw the immigration system changing for the worst, because people, non kind of white Western European immigrants, were allowed to come into this country in droves. And so you listen to someone like Jeff Sessions kind of use this kind of racial nostalgist kind of rhetoric about how in the past the complexion of the country was different. Now we have we're overrun. All of this is driven by racial anxiety.
We're going to take a brief break, but when we call back, your piece is drawing a lot of interest, and we have some callers on the line. Now, I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm speaking with New Yorker staff writer Jonathan Blitzer about his recent article titled, How the Trump Administration Got Comfortable Separating Immigrant Kids from Their Parents. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. And welcome back. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm talking with New Yorker staff writer Jonathan Blitzer on how the Trump administration got comfortable separating immigrant kids from their parents. We have a caller on the line right now who's been moved by what you're saying, Jonathan. I want to introduce Kevin from Morris Plains. Kevin, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? And hello, Jonathan. I appreciate how you, attributing this to the current administration and the people involved in the current administration and Mr. Jefferson Davis, the Attorney General. Let's use his full name. But isn't this a recapitulation, a trying to resurface the Fugitive Slave Act of the 1850s?
Interesting. Jonathan, are there parallels with the Fugitive Slave Act?
Tell me more what you're thinking is, Kevin.
Well, the law was passed, the southern states fought for this, that they wanted this act that if a slave was captured escaping from a southern state into a northern state, his family would be separated. His family would be thrown, as it is said in the documents back then, thrown to the winds, that they would separate the families as a punishment for the adult that tried to escape.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I think any time the government is willing publicly, in a matter of official policy, to treat people in over-the-top inhumane ways like this, there's legitimate reason to question kind of deep underlying racism that's driving the policy. So I definitely identify and appreciate the historical parallel there.
Thank you very much, Kevin. So Jonathan, I want to talk about some very, very specifics about how these people are being housed. Earlier this month, we had Senator Jeff Merkley visited the McClellan Border Patrol station in Texas, where he saw immigrant children in what, is described as big cages made out of fencing and wire and nets stretched across the top of them so that people can't climb out. And that's a direct quote. He was later denied a tour of the Office of Refugee Resettlement Facility, where immigrant children are also being held in Brownsville, Texas. When the senator asked about the abysmal conditions, officers responded, this is what's required for security. That's what's required for control. So, Jonathan, what exactly is the Trump administration seeking to control with these conditions?
Well, I think there have been longstanding concerns about the conditions of immigrant detention centers, and I do think, though, that the current administration brings a different perspective to this because they have, I think, a broader agenda. And that concerns some laws that exist, laws and policies, federal policies, that dictate basically what some minimum standards are for the conditions of a center or the detention center that holds minors. And so there was a law from 2008, and there is a federal agreement from the 90s that basically say all things that would strike you as being more or less intuitive. If you've got a minor in your custody, you should keep them in detention for as short a period as possible under the least restrictive setting possible. And I think the White House, and certainly Jeff Sessions, because he's been explicit about it in the past, has wanted those laws and policies changed. And so I do think that one outcome you might see here is a broader push from the administration to use the current crisis, to use the fact right now that some of these facilities are overrun, to say, look, we have to reconsider even just some of the broad policies and laws that have typically guided detention of minors. And so, what's happening is when these kids are getting separated from their parents, they're being treated as so-called unaccompanied minors. And that's a category of person we've seen for years and the government has dealt with for years. It's basically, it came onto people's sort of consciousness in 2014. There was a humanitarian crisis at the border when tens of thousands of kids between the ages of 6 and 17 came from Central America fleeing violence in the region, looking to get reunited with family members living in the U.S.
But Jonathan, hold on one second, because when we talk about unaccompanied minors, I'm thinking about someone, a living being that needs to be nurtured, cared for, but the description of these children in cages with fencing and wire nets stretched across the top of them so that people can't climb out is deeply disturbing. It almost is a treatment of children, these immigrant non-white children, as animals.
I share your horror for sure. The reason I'm going through this history, I don't mean to take you through this policy drudgery, but it matters somewhat because what's going on now is the facilities that were meant to take care of these kids briefly, who came as unaccompanied minors, that these facilities are being overrun now because in addition to that population of kids who came to the U.S. alone, you now have kids who have been actively separated from their parents at the border. And so the broader, I'm just trying to give you kind of a sense of what I think the broader play is here from the administration, because it speaks directly to your concerns. I think the broader play is this administration wants eventually for the laws that in the past have said, okay, kids need to be held in less restrictive settings, in places that are more responsive to their needs. They want to roll that back. And I actually think in some ways what the administration wants is to be able to detain parents and kids together. And once you get into that space, you do have very, very ugly detention conditions. And I don't think you're wrong to describe the conditions the way you do. I'm in agreement. But I think that there is a deeper play here. And that is the few protections that do exist for the conditions in which these kids are held when they cross the border. Those conditions, those standards are going to be eroded slowly by this administration.
I understand that some of the children are being funneled all over the country. Some have made their way here to New York and in facilities. I also understand, based on reading some of your work, that one of the social service agencies for immigrant children is operating out of an old Walmart with blacked out windows. Is that true?
You're referring to the center in Brownsville,
yeah.
Texas. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't part of the group. There was a group of reporters who gained access to that facility, I believe, yesterday or certainly earlier this week, and they've begun to describe in detail what that center looks like. I have not been inside it myself. What you're describing generally, you're describing kind of a combination of things. I mean, there is typically, when a kid shows up at the border alone, the government processes that child in a facility overseen by the Department of Health and Human Services, and more specifically, a division of the Department of Health and Human Services called the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Now, obviously, these facilities are totally overrun because suddenly they're having to deal with huge influxes of kids who are just washing through their facilities, and the facilities are not equipped to deal with it. And so you're starting to see the administration float ideas for what to do with all of these kids who are coming into their custody. And this is stuff that I'm sure you've seen by now. Scary things like, holding kids on military bases and that sort of thing. I mean, there is a crisis that this administration has created for itself, and obviously the people who suffer as the administration tries to figure out the policy behind it are these children.
We're getting a lot of messages on social media, and I want to make sure, if anyone wants to join this conversation, our number here is 212-433-9692. Again, 212-433-9692. Have you, do you know someone, or has it happened to you where your children have been separated from you because of immigration issues? If so, call us and tell us your story. Jonathan, how is this influx already affecting these congested courts in the U.S. system?
Well, the problem is that when you prosecute everyone who crosses the border, whereas in the past what you do is you'd say, okay, we're taking you into detention, we're going to determine whether or not you have a legitimate asylum claim, and if we feel that you do, we'll release you pending a future court date. What's happening now is they're arresting everyone, putting everyone into detention, but first bringing them to federal court, criminal court, to charge them for the misdemeanor of entering the country illegally. And so these courts are totally overrun. I mean, you're talking about courts along the border that, you know, are dealing now with 1,000 cases a day, which is obviously overwhelming. And it raises serious questions, too, about what actual rights are being afforded to people who cross the border. They're being charged criminally. They're desperate to get reunited with their kids. A lot of the reporting on this has I mean, there have been horrible, horrible stories of parents talking about quickly pleading guilty to various, you know, to this charge of crossing illegally simply so they could get out of the criminal processing system faster and try to figure out where their kids are. So the fact that these courts are overrun means that the people who are being processed in these courts, these immigrants, are being, you know, shoved through the process without really having meaningful rights or opportunities to work through their legal situation.
What is it like in the moment where the separation takes place? Do officials tell the parent that the child is going here? Is there a phone call? Is there anything to prepare them for the moment when they are no longer able to hold their child's hand?
It's a really good question. I don't know at this point. A lot of people are doggedly trying to report this out, and have been a lot of reporters have done a great job in getting close to understanding what this moment of separation looks like. For the most part, what I'm seeing are just accounts that parents have given to lawyers. I mean, the witnesses to these horrible separations are in detention, so it's hard to get kind of a full sense of the story. But my understanding is that the people who are doing the separating are agents with Border Patrol, and other reporters have told the story that in some cases Border Patrol agents have told mothers and fathers, okay, look, we just need to take your kid for a bath. Ugh. And then that's that. Or they'll say, you know, all kinds of sort of anodyne things, and the parent at first is unsuspecting, and then only later realizes what's happened. I hope in further reporting to get a better sense of what this looks like, because I think it's extremely important for us to look at it unflinchingly. Obviously, horrible, horrible stuff.
We understand that hundreds of these children are less than 4 years old. What ends up happening to these children? Will they become U.S. citizens separate from their parents, or do they get deported?
It's a good question, and this is a population that hasn't, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services, which typically treats unaccompanied kids, hasn't really ever had to deal with in this way before. I'm not sure exactly what is going to happen to some of these kids in the long run. I think so far, my conversations with advocates along the border have, in one sense, it's every conversation you have is just wrenching and gutting. But on the other, I am somewhat reassured by the fact of how hard these advocates are fighting to make sure that even if the government isn't properly able to account for the parent and the child, advocates actually are trying to reconstruct kind of where people are going so the kids aren't getting completely, completely disconnected and lost to their parents. But I do think there are actually kind of complex legal and ethical questions that are coming up now, too, that lawyers maybe never would have had to consider before in the absence of this policy, which is, okay, you're representing a two-year-old kid. How do you represent that kid's needs? And also, you need to represent the parent's needs at the same time. So how are you balancing these things if you don't have access to the parent, but you're representing a child, and that child is, say, pre-verbal? How do you even have a meaningful conversation with a child in that situation? I mean, these are open questions, open and horrifically ugly questions.
Yeah, I've heard some reports where the administration says that some of these missing children have perhaps been reunited with their families and they're just laying low underground. Any truth to that?
I certainly don't. I don't know anything of that sort that's happened. I mean, I think that there have been cases where parents and their kids have been reunited. I think there are also many, many cases in which they haven't been. So the fact that this is happening, the fact that at some point a parent might get reunited with a child, isn't in any meaningful way a response to the crisis that the administration has created.
Some of this is happening when children are at an incredibly critical age in their emotional and mental development. So, for example, if you are ripped away from your parents, what happens when it's time for you to go to school?
Yeah, and I mean, you're getting at something too that has deep sort of medical implications and health implications. I mean, you know, you're talking about kids who are developmentally extremely vulnerable. What kinds of lasting consequences will there be physically, emotionally, mentally? Pediatricians have spoken out about this and are extremely concerned. I think there's no question that the trauma will have deep and dark long-term consequences, and sadly, it's hard even to fully fathom what those consequences will be in the life of a child.
It's easy to begin to imagine that these consequences will be felt by the families, the children, the parents. Mm-hmm. But what about for the rest of the country, America in general, for the people who say that they're not connected to cases like this? Do you think there's a broader impact for all of us?
I think this is one of those bright line kind of moments where it's sort of a gut check and you have to decide, you know, at what point you're willing to allow this sort of policy to be carried out in your name. And so I do think, I mean, as utterly horrible as the situation is, I'm somewhat heartened by the outcry. It's proof that people are paying attention. I don't think people were paying attention to the same degree several months ago, or certainly it was hard to in any kind of systematic way because so many things were happening at once from this administration. But one thing that I do hope comes out of this current moment is that the country needs to be very clear, people in this country need to be very clear about what their values are, what's being done in citizens' names, and also to understand that this administration, for all of its outward signs of chaos, on the immigration policy front, they're pretty systematic and pretty efficient about carrying out this deeper agenda. And I think it's really time that people recognize what that means.
Do you think that we will look back in history and see that we were on the wrong side?
Yes. And I think that was true even before this this particular family separation policy came to the fore. I mean, I think this is a stark example of what will be a historical blight in this country's history. I think the same could be said for all sorts of treatment of immigrants in this country right now, related to this increased and in very, very aggressive enforcement of immigration laws, indefinite detention of immigrants, separation of families inside the country. I mean, we're talking about separation of families along the border, just in terms of this new policy. But families are being separated every day as a result of immigration enforcement. Families are being torn apart. People are being deported. I really do think that we're going to look back on this moment, and it is going to be a chilling, chilling thing to reconsider what we're going through.
A chilling moment in U.S. history. Thank you so much for joining me. Excellent work, Jonathan. And I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I've been speaking with New York staff writer Jonathan Blitzer about his recent article titled "How the Trump Administration Got Comfortable Separating Immigrant Kids from Their Parents." Thanks, Jonathan.